Well, when we met last time, we had just begun 1 Kings chapter 16. And that opens with the story of King Baasha's inglorious and shameful end. Now, we're going to reread the entire chapter, but first, I want to set the stage for tonight's lesson with some words spoken by C.F. Kiel, that great 19th century German biblical scholar, as concerns especially the behavior and the character of the kings of the northern tribes of Israel. He says this of them: "There was something very strange in the perversity and the stolidity of the kings of Israel." Essentially, Kiel's take is that each new king's insistence on emulating and outdoing the wickedness of the previous king of Israel that they succeeded cannot be accounted for in normal carnal human terms, because they personally saw, or they were directly involved in, the destructive outcome of the previous king and his regime. These new kings were smart. They were cunning. So why would they do the same things these deposed kings did, but think they would achieve a successful outcome? In fact, this kind of mindset is reflected in a modern proverb that says, "The definition of insanity is to keep doing the same things while expecting a different result." Now, no doubt, this strange perversity that dominated the lives of the kings of Israel, that we see exposed through the books of the kings, was a kind of a spiritual blindness, or at the least their lack of interest of in dipping into the bountiful well of godly wisdom and instead choosing something else from a much darker source. And that something else is identified for us. It's idolatry. But as we began to reread 1 Kings chapter 16, I want you to keep something in mind. Up to this point in Israel's history, the idolatry of the northern tribes that was begun in earnest by King Jeroboam was expressed primarily in the worship of those golden calves that he ordered to be built. One of them was set up in Beit El, and the other one set up in the city of Dan. And in a rather convoluted way, it's not that the northern tribes stopped worshiping Yehovah, God of Israel. Rather, the golden calves were largely meant to be representations of Yehovah, meant to replace the God-ordained symbols that existed in the temple in Jerusalem. Of course, to create this graven image violated the Torah law that was given to Moses in the second commandment, but to their thinking, they weren't giving up their God. They were merely mixing some standard pagan ways with the worship of Yehovah, and in their spiritual blindness felt that the era had passed when such a thing as making God images was even prohibited. So, with that as a background, let's reread 1 Kings chapter 16. 1 Kings chapter 16, page 390, if you have a complete Jewish Bible. The word of Adonai came to Jehu, the son of Hanani, against Baasha. "I raised you up out of the dust. I made you prince over my people Israel. But you have lived in the same way as Jeroboam, and you've caused my people Israel to sin, so that their sinning has made me angry. Therefore, I will sweep away Baasha and his house completely. I'll make your house like the house of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. If someone from the line of Baasha dies in the city, the dogs will eat him. If he dies in the countryside, the vultures will eat him." Other activities of Baasha, his accomplishments and his power, are recorded in the annals of the king of Israel. Baasha slept with his ancestors, and Elah, his son, became king in his place. Through the prophet Jehu, the son of Hanani, the word of Adonai was proclaimed against Baasha and his house, both because he did so much evil from Adonai's perspective, angering him with his actions and becoming like the house of Jeroboam, and because he killed Nadav. It was in the 26th year of Asa, king of Judah, that Elah, the son of Baasha, began his reign over all Israel in Tirzah, and he ruled for 2 years. His servant Zimri, commander of half of his chariots, plotted against him. Finally, one time when Elah was in Tirzah, drinking himself senseless in the house of Arzah, administrator of the palace in Tirzah, Zimri entered and struck him down and killed him. This was in the 27th year of Asa, king of Judah. Zimri then took Elah's place as king. At the beginning of his reign, as soon as he took over the throne, he killed off the entire house of Baasha. He left not a single male, neither of his relatives nor of his friends. Thus, Zimri eliminated all the house of Baasha in keeping with the word of Adonai spoken against Baasha through Jehu the prophet. This word had been spoken because of all of Baasha's sins and the sins of Elah's son, which they committed and with which they made Israel sin, thereby angering Adonai, the God of Israel, with their worthless idols. Other activities of Elah and all of his accomplishments are recorded in the annals of the kings of Israel. Now it was in the 27th year of Asa, king of Judah, that Zimri ruled for 7 days in Tirzah. At that time, the army was besieging Gibeon, which belonged to the Philistines. The troops in their camp heard it said that Zimri had plotted and killed the king, whereupon that same day there in the camp, all Israel made Omri, the commander of the army, king over Israel. Omri and all Israel with him withdrew from Gibeon and besieged Tirzah. And when Zimri saw that the city had been captured, he went into the citadel of the royal palace. He burned down the royal palace over him so that he died. This came about because of the sins he committed in doing what was evil from Adonai's perspective and living as Jeroboam had lived and in sinning by making Israel sin. Other activities of Zimri and his conspiracy are recorded in the annals of the kings of Israel. Now, at this point, the people of Israel divided into two factions. Half of the people went after Tibni, the son of Ginath, to make him king, while the other half followed Omri. But the faction supporting Omri won out over that of Zimni, the son of Ginath, so Zimni died, and Omri became king. Now, it was in the 31st year of Asa, king of Judah, that Omri began his reign over Israel, and he ruled for 12 years, 6 of them in Tirzah. He bought Mount Shomron, Mount Samaria, from Shemer for 132 pounds of silver. And on the mountain, he built a city, which he named Shomron, after Shemer, who had owned the mountain. Omri did what was evil from Adonai's perspective, outdoing all of his predecessors in wickedness, for he lived entirely in the manner of Jeroboam, the son of Nevat, committing the sins with which he made Israel sin, thereby angering Adonai, the God of Israel, with their worthless idols. Other activities of Omri and the power he demonstrated are recorded in the annals of the kings of Israel. Then Omri slept with his ancestors. He was buried in Shomron, and Achav, his son, became king in his place. It was in the 38th year of Asa, king of Judah, that Achav, the son of Omri, began his rule over Israel. Achav, the son of Omri, ruled 22 years over Israel in Samaria. Achav, the son of Omri, did what was evil from Adonai's perspective, outdoing all of his predecessors in wickedness. But then, as if it had been a trifling thing for him to commit the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nevat, he took as his wife Jezebel, the daughter of Etbaal, king of the Sidonim, and he went and served Baal and worshipped him. He erected an altar for Baal in the house of Baal, which he had built in Samaria. Achav also set up the Asherah. Indeed, Achav did more to anger Adonai, the God of Israel, than all the kings of Israel preceding him. It was during his time that Hiel of Bethel rebuilt Jericho. He laid his foundation at the cost of his firstborn son, Avraham, and erected its gates at the cost of his youngest son, Shuv. This was in keeping with the word of Adonai spoken through Joshua, the son of Nun. King Baasha, I think it's fair to say, was an abject failure. He had been prophetically given the task of wreaking God's judgment upon the dynasty of Jeroboam, by destroying it down to the last man. But instead of recognizing that the wickedness of Jeroboam and of his son Nadab were the true source of their demise, and that the only way that Baasha could ever have attained his new regal standing was at the hand of the God of Israel, Baasha merely continued in those same wicked ways, and so he would share the same fate as those kings who came before him and after him. And as we discussed early in our lessons on the Book of Kings, the time references used are based always synchronizing the reigns of the kings of Judah with the kings of Israel. And I want to remind you that the former glory days of a united sovereign nation of Israel under David and Solomon, one that incorporated all 12 tribes plus the Levites, were over. And that nation had undergone a civil war. Now it was split into two independent kingdoms. The kingdom to the south was called Judah, and in chapter 16 is being ruled by King Asa. The kingdom in the north was called Israel, and it consisted of 10 Israelite tribes. This is the kingdom over which Baasha reigned. King Asa would continue in power in Judah for almost 40 years and watch many kings come and go in the northern kingdom. Now, verse 1 has God's prophet Yehu pronouncing a curse, the death penalty, over the house of Baasha. Now, it's interesting to me that despite that terrible idolatry and sin that the people of Israel were committing, God hadn't disowned them. I mean, notice how in verse 2, the Lord refers still to them as my people, Israel. This is the loving reminder of a father who just longs for his children to repent and to return to him. It is equally interesting that the curse against Baasha's family, in one sense, didn't apply directly to him. Instead of being murdered or dying young, Baasha ruled for over 20 years and he died of natural causes. He was respectfully buried in the city of Tirzah, which he used as his capital. And after him followed his son Elah. It is this son who would suffer the prophetic curse that was pronounced by the prophet Yehu. Now, Elah is said to have ruled for only 2 years. However, it's important to remember that because of the dating system used for kings at this time in history, those 2 years are referring not to an overall span of time of 2 years, like 24 months, but rather to the fact that he reigned during parts of two consecutive calendar years, generally agreed to have been the years 883-882 BC. He began his rule over Israel in the 26th year of King Asa's reign over Judah, and Elah only ruled Israel for a few months. As we're told, he died in the 27th year of King Asa's reign. Verse 10 says that Elah was murdered by one of his own military commanders named Zimri. Now, what we're about to see from here forward is a new dynamic in Israel in which the military leaders use their armies to put themselves into power by force. This only became possible because, you see, once King David became king, he created a substantial standing army in Israel instead of just having a militia. This army of professional Israelite soldiers, of course, recognized their power. And so during these chaotic times, they saw fit to use that power to their advantage. In most aspects, Israel was becoming a kingdom ruled as a military state. Now, we're told that like his father, Elah used the city of Tirzah as his capital city. It is interesting to know that Tirzah, as were most cities, was named after its founder. Tirzah was a woman that we encountered back in Numbers 27. Her father was Zelophehad, and his wives had borne him no sons, only daughters. And as the 12 tribes were nearing the promised land, and as the result of a sentence, these daughters had approached Moses and demanded that their family be given territory in Canaan, even though there were no sons and their father was dead. Zelophehad was of the tribe of Manasseh. Let's recall that. Back in Numbers 27, starting in verse 1. Then the daughters of Zelophehad, the son of Hepher, the son of Gilad, the son of Machir, the son of Manasseh, of the families of Manasseh, the son of Joseph, approached. These were the names of his daughters, Machla, Noah, Hogla, Milcah, and Tirzah. And they stood in front of Moses, Eleazar the priest, the leaders, and the whole community at the entrance to the tent of meeting and said, "Our father died in the desert. He wasn't part of the group who assembled themselves to rebel against Adonai and Korah's group, but he died in his own sin and he had no sons. Why should the name of our father be eliminated from his family just because he didn't have a son? Give us property to pass along with the brothers of our father." Moses brought their cause before Adonai, and Adonai answered Moses, "The daughters of Zelophehad are right in what they say. You must give them property to be inherited along with that of their father's brothers. Have what their father would have inherited passed to them." So in the city, the northern kings were using as their capital city, it was in Manasseh's tribal territory, and it had been founded by Zelophehad's daughter, Tirzah, and it was still going by that name all these centuries later. Now, Zimri commanded a brigade of chariots. In fact, we're told that half of the chariot forces of the entire northern kingdom were under his command. And it's clear from what follows, Zimri was not particularly a popular commander. And neither did his sway extend beyond his own chariot brigade. And what was an obvious conspiracy? Zimri used a moment in time to assassinate King Elah when the bulk of the Israelite army was away laying siege to a Philistine enclave called Gibbethon. Now, apparently the king was lured to some drunken party arranged by a co-conspirator named Arzah, who was actually the house steward over the king's palace. And after Elah had lapsed into an alcohol-caused stupor, Zimri murdered him. And he declared himself to be the king of Israel. But to his surprise, the Israelite military wouldn't support him. Verses 11 and 12 explain that Zimri immediately set about to kill not only all the male relatives and offspring of Elah, but even Elah's friends. But in most Bibles, including our complete Jewish Bible, where it uses the English word relatives, those who were killed by Zimri, in reality, this gives us the wrong impression. The Hebrew word used there is ga'al, and it means kinsman redeemer. So the idea is that those in Elah's family, the kinsman redeemers, who would be duty bound now to reclaim the honor of Elah's family by hunting down Elah's killer, who was Zimri, were promptly done away with. And for all practical purposes, that meant every male family member, no matter how young, and it could also have meant no female was spared, who was close enough in bloodline to Elah to produce a male child who could assume a kinsman redeemer role at some later date. So Baasha's bloodlines were completely terminated at the death of his son Elah. All of his living descendants, as well as possible future descendants in fulfillment of the curse handed down by God's prophet Jehu, were done away with. The reason for God's anger to cause this slaughter is stated in verse 13. It says there, it was because of all of Baasha's and his son Elah's sins, and in turn, their sinful leadership caused the people of Israel to sin, which meant that the holy and just God of Israel had no choice but to take action that would be harmful to his people. But more, the end of the verse says that another reason was because of their worthless idols. Other versions say it was because of their vanities, and this is a superior translation. The Hebrew word being translated is havel, and it means having the characteristics of vapor or breath. Now you see it, now you don't. Something that has almost no substance. It's here for a moment and it's gone. Rabbi Baruch taught us at a fairly recent Love Israel conference that the idea is similar to another Hebrew word that's used in Amos chapter 7. And that word is ishach. And the learned rabbis say this word means to play around, to do worthless things. And that essentially also is also the meaning of havel. So instead of the kings of Israel teaching their people to do what God has commanded, they have led the people to do lots of religious stuff. But those religious actions have no value in God's eyes. This is exposing a very important God principle that has eaten at my soul for a long time. Because Christ's church has ventured far down this same dark path from which few of the brethren will likely ever return. The sense of what's being said in verse 13 is that the Israelite people, as led by their leaders, ceased worshiping God in the ways he says he wants to be worshiped. And instead, they've taken up worship practices that they enjoy, but in reality were nothing but vanity, vapor, had no substance at all. They tried to worship him in ways that were in tune with their pagan neighbors, in ways that served a leadership agenda, in ways that seemed less stringent and a lot more fun, and in tune with the times, and with the predominant freewheeling culture. These ways serve to try and make the God of Israel seem more attractive, more winsome. The people actually believed they were doing good because their leaders told them what they were doing was good. But these ways were simply vanity, amounted to no worship at all. In those times, there were no scrolls. There were no books of the Torah for the general population to consult. Those were in the sole possession of the priesthood. For the average family, there was only whatever word-of-mouth traditions that had been handed down from generation to generation. So it was primarily the leaders of Israel, secular and priesthood, that God held responsible for the people's perverse behavior and their pagan worship practices, since it was they who taught the people. And we read of God's attitude concerning that here. And we're going to read of the same as we continue on through the book of the Kings. But you know, in our modern era, the general population has no such built-in excuse for gleefully following our blind guides that today pass for our religious leadership. Christians especially don't have to ignorantly believe our political leadership and fall prey to their power and to their social agendas that often use Bible passages taken out of context and supposed better moral positions that reflect modern intellectual enlightenment to achieve it. Bibles are available to us anywhere from cheap to free. Good, sound biblical teaching can be had on the internet, often at no cost, if one just wishes to take the time to find it. The congregation can only be fooled if we want to be fooled, because we like what we hear. And while our Christian leadership bears much of the blame for this state of affairs, unlike the era of the kings, the general Christian population is all also on the hook for God's wrath, and we see that personal, individual responsibility for our behavior, our religious observances, and our worship practices is emphasized all throughout the New Testament. One must understand that in the Oriental mindset, the end of Elah's family meant that his father, Baasha's eternal essence, would also end, as it was thought to be transmitted from generation to generation by means of a son's bloodlines. It was truly the worst possible curse that a human could fear, the simultaneous end of one's physical life and the end of one's eternal soul. So what we have is that Baasha killed off all the bloodlines, and so he terminated the eternal life essence of Jeroboam's family. And now Zimri has done the same to Baasha. But Zimri's reign over Israel would be short-lived. In fact, it is probably not even correct to call him a king of Israel. Rather, it is a title that he gave to himself. And a few in Israel even acknowledged it. Further, as verse 15 explains, his so-called reign lasted 7 days. Not much of a reign. Was there even a coronation ceremony? Probably not. Verse 16 explains that when the Israelite army that was besieging Gibeon heard about King Elah's assassination and about Zimri declaring himself king, they became enraged, determined that if any military commander would be king, it was going to be Omri. So they quit their siege of the Philistine fortress city, and they marched to their own capital city of Tirzah, and they laid siege to it. Zimri was caught by surprise, and he was trapped. And seeing that he had no chance to survive, he fled into the palace. He set it on fire, committing suicide. So he was denying Omri the honor of executing him and even of having a royal palace. Now, I want to point out that we've run into the term all Israel on a number of occasions in this chapter, and we will in the following chapters as well. What we have to be careful of is applying its meaning in the proper context. In general, from a political and a national standpoint, the term Israel right now means those 10 northern tribes and does not include Judah. However, from a spiritual standpoint, Israel in God's eyes means all of the tribes. Even more, all Israel at times means the specific people involved in an action. So when we're told in verse 17 that all Israel made Omri king of Israel, it really only means the Israelite army at Gibeon and not all of the civilian population. This section of the narrative ends by telling us that the other things that occurred during Zimri's brief reign, as well as all the details of the assassination conspiracy, are recorded in the Book of the Kings of Israel, which is a lost work. But things weren't going very well for Omri either, because verse 21 tells us that the people of Israel weren't entirely on board with this idea of a military coup that ended up with a professional soldier now occupying Israel's throne. This would have deeply upset the tribal princes. The citizens of the northern kingdom itself now split into two factions. One that was with Omri, the other which preferred to have a fellow named Tidni, son of Ginat. It was apparently a fairly even split. Now, no doubt it was the military that was for Omri and the civilians who were for Tibni. Now, we really don't know anything about Tibni because this is the only mention of him in the biblical record. But it's almost certain he was a civilian, or he certainly would have been identified as controlling a certain part of the military, Terry, rather than being labeled the son of so-and-so. Well, what goes around tends to come around, doesn't it? It was the northern tribal princes under Jeroboam's leadership that wanted to secede from the unified nation of Israel, and their greed split God's earthly kingdom into two. Now, because of jealousies and infighting and this lust for power, we have the northern kingdom split into two and operating as two separate factions. So what we find is that there was this ongoing battle for probably around 4 years between Omri and Tibni in this fight to reunite the northern tribes. Now, no doubt, as the northern alliance completely fractured, there was no clear-cut nation any longer. The tribes gained back a lot of autonomy, and now it is that the most powerful tribe of them all, Ephraim, starts to assert its dominance. It is now that the northern territory begins to evolve from Israel, a national-oriented name, to Ephraim, a tribal-oriented name. And like the patriarch Jacob, who came to be known by two different names, Israel and Yitzhak, so it is that the northern kingdom is now going to go forward by two different names, the national name of Israel and the tribal name of Ephraim. This is something that all Bible students must be acutely aware of from this time forward in history, because the Israelite people have to be identified in a certain way. If we can grasp each step in history of the evolution of Israel. Otherwise, it can become significantly confusing, especially when we're dealing with end times prophecies concerning Israel. Well, in time, Tibni died. A lot of speculation as to whether he died in battle or for some other cause. That event ended the power struggle. The northern kingdom now had one king, Omri. It happened in the 31st year that King Asa was reigning in Judah. So as an aside, we see that Judah, while all this mess is going on up in the northern kingdom, has enjoyed a relatively long period of political and religious stability. At the same time, the northern kingdom of Israel is going through coup after coup, king after king. During the first 6 years of his reign, during the first 7 or 8 years of his reign, Tirzah was was Omri's capital. During the first 6 years of his reign, he continued to use the city of Tirzah. However, it must have become apparent to this military commander that Tirzah was not easily defended. So when peace was finally attained, he sought to move his capital city to a place that was a lot more formidable and secure. Well, the story of the move of Israel's capital city to a hilly region that in time came to be called Samaria is now told in verse 24. And it seems that Omri purchased a hilltop from a fellow named Shemer. So Omri called the place Shemeron. Apparently, at some later time, it got vocalized a little differently, and so it began to sound like Shomron, and that's how we find it in the Bible. In reality, Shemeron and Shomron are spelled exactly the same in the all-consonant Hebrew alphabet. The vowel sounds had to be known through experience because they weren't written down. Well, the place Omri chose was a plateau, about 1,400 feet high, 6 miles northwest of Shechem. It was a commanding location. It was surrounded by mountains with only a narrow entrance from the west. There was a steep approach to the top from all sides, and it had abundant water, very important. It was a perfect location for a fortress and a defensible capital. Well, verse 25 explains that once again, Israel's king took the low road. He is said to have been worse than all the kings that came before him. And once again, we're told that Omri led the people in the ways of religious vanities that didn't honor God. It just angered him. So let's remember that the place Israel had arrived and Omri was now leading them to was the result of this steady slide that had gone on for decades. Omri could hardly be blamed as the sole cause for such a confused and backslidden society. But when Omri died and his son Ahav took over, an entire new dynamic began. History shows us that there are moments when the wrong leader at the wrong time can take a bad situation and turn it into a catastrophe. Asa was still king of Judah. So there's not a lot of biblical mention of what was going on in Judah at this time. It was nearing the end of Asa's reign that Ahav came into power in the north, and his rule and leadership was by far the worst ever seen by an Israelite king. It was so devastating that the least of his bad leadership was to continue in the ways of the idolatrous Jeroboam. But now he took a path from which the northern kingdom would never recover. He married a pagan woman named Jezebel. And he and she became co-rulers over Israel. Jezebel was the daughter of the notorious Baal worshiper Ethbaal, king of Sidon and Tyre. Ethbaal had murdered his own brother, Phelus, to become king. He made himself the chief priest of Astarte, and his daughter Jezebel took after him in every way. Obviously, this was something that Ahav sought for himself. After their marriage, Ahav did the unthinkable. He renounced Yahweh as Israel's God. And as bad as the golden calves of Jeroboam were, at least they were considered to be images of Yahweh. And so Yahweh continued to be seen by the people and the kings as Israel's God, but no longer. Baal and Astarte were now the official and legal father and mother gods of the northern kingdom of Israel. And as a result, we begin to see a great extension in the role of Yahweh's prophets at this time as a counter to Baal worship. Starting with Elijah, we will see a whole series of divine power and miracles on display because anything else wasn't going to make any impact at all. Now, I want to dare to venture off to end this evening's lesson in hopes we can learn something important from this pattern of behavior of Israel's kings and what the effect upon their nation was. What I'm about to say is absolutely in no way intended as partisan politics, nor is it to overgeneralize. However, all leadership of a nation or an institution, religious or secular, is inherently political. So there is no way to discuss one without the other. Today is one of the saddest times, in my view, in the history of the church. And I have no doubt that it has turned an important and dangerous corner within the last couple of decades. There is at present great apostasy within many of our Christian institutions, and in response, God is raising up a new movement of pastors and teachers and leaders who have shunned the traditional church seminaries that simply replicate and multiply the worthless traditions of men that have replaced the matchless Word of God. It ought not to surprise us that because of where we are in the timeline of redemption history, that this movement revolves around Israel, around the Jewish people, around God's Torah, around the entire body of Holy Scriptures, almost all of which is now considered to be nearly irrelevant, worthless, even heretical and a danger to a large segment of the mainstream church, both in the East and in the West. With no authority whatsoever to do so, centuries ago, church leadership adopted two pagan holidays, attached Christ's holy name to them, and then declared those holidays to be the two most holy days of the year for Christians. Against the express recorded instructions of our Savior, the entire foundation of God's Word has been torn out and dismissed from our Bibles and declared abolished and nailed to the cross. This was done at the same time that all God-ordained appointed times were banished from our midst, calling those who continuing to faithfully observe those biblical holy days Judaizers, or worse. A 2009 survey of the church in America, accomplished by the respected Barna Group, shows that only 34% of self-identified Christians believe in the absolute moral truth of the Holy Scriptures. 34%, a third of self-proclaimed Christians. Half believe that the Bible is accurate in its principles. Most believe that the sacred books of other religions, such as Islam and Buddhism, are on par with and teach the same principles as the Bible. A mere 40% believe that a person can be affected by spiritual forces, such as demons or angels, and only 27% polled believe Satan exists. Scary stuff. On the political front, ex-President Bill Clinton brought gay and lesbian issues to the forefront and declared them normal and desirable. He championed same-sex marriage that has become law in most states, abortion on demand, and personally demonstrated and instructed us that sexual morality is dead. Our next president, George Bush, stood in a mosque shortly after 9/11, declared the God of Christianity and the God of Islam are the same God. Then in June 2007, candidate Barack Obama said this: "Whatever we once were, we're no longer a Christian nation." In April 2009, President Obama, on a diplomatic visit to Turkey, told his Islamic audience, "We do not consider ourselves to be a Christian nation. We consider ourselves to be a nation of citizens who are bound by ideals and a set of common values." You see, it always takes a series of steps and stages brought about over time by bad leadership to finally arrive at a new reality. From challenging biblical values to declaring that there is no difference between the God of the Bible and any other God, to finally officially telling the world that as an American society and as a government, we no longer hold, in fact, we reject God-ordained biblical values, and we will decide those values for ourselves, took only a few misguided leaders 2 or 3 decades to accomplish. It was that path that was the same as the way of the kings of Israel. Now it is the way of America and the way of the largest mainstream Christian denominations. For ancient Israel, in time, it all ended in their exile, and it was the end of their nation. What's it going to be for America? what's it going to be for the church? Do you have courage and trust to do what's right in God's eyes and return to the path of holiness and a purer worship? Are you going to succumb to the comfortable, to the familiar, to the preferred, to follow the ways of the bigger crowds? This chapter ends by telling us that a fellow named Hiel from Bethel decided to rebuild the fortress city of Jericho that had been supernaturally destroyed by God in Joshua's day. In Joshua 6:26, we're told of a curse that the Lord issued against anyone who would suppose to rebuild that which he has torn down. And the curse was that the rebuilder of Jericho would lose his sons in the process if he dared to do it. That's exactly what happened to Hiel. I want to be clear that Hiel did not go as a private citizen and decide that he would personally resurrect the ruins of Jericho as a kind of private residence. No doubt the point of placing this notice here in chapter 16 was to connect Hiel with King Ahab's administration. It would take the resources of a royal treasury, hundreds of workers for this kind of endeavor. No king would allow a private citizen to erect a private fortress city within his national territory. Even the wicked kings before Ahab knew enough to steer clear of trying to rebuild Jericho, no matter what a wonderfully strategic location that it was. But Ahab, who had renounced all allegiance to Yahweh, God of Israel, along with his wife Jezebel, they didn't have any kind of misgivings against doing that. We'll begin chapter 17 next time.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.